A very warm welcome to The Front Page, the show from The Racing Post that tells you everything you need to know about what's happening in racing in under 40 minutes. And my, what a show we've got coming up today. It's been a packed weekend, both sides of the Irish Sea. We'll also be digging into what happened last week at the racing strike and lots more besides. For such a busy show, you need a top-class panel, and that's exactly what I've got. I've got Matty Pleo, James Stevens, and David Jennings calling in from Ireland. So without wasting a single moment, we're going to crack on and get straight into the top story, which is Irish Champions Festival, and in particular, that stunning victory by Delacroix. DJ, you were there. Tell us about what you saw.
I'll start with Delacroix. I was at the Ballydoyle press morning in the lead up to the Irish Champions Festival, and you know, Aidan is great at building up his horses, you have to say. Like, if any company wanted somebody to build them up, ring Aidan, because he's great at doing it. And to be honest, he was saying stuff about Delacroix that I didn't really believe, to be honest with you. He has everything, he is this, he is that, and I was kind of like, oh, you know, we've kind of heard this before. I'm not sure if Delacroix is quite as good as Aidan said. And then on that home turn, he just accelerated. And it was the first time with Delacroix. I know at Sandown, it was unusual in the way he won the Eclipse, given so much went wrong, but it just looked a bizarre race. This was the first time with Delacroix I went, whoa, he actually does have that instant acceleration. And it went from being a wide open race to bang, the race is over in a couple of strides. I fancied Amnat, and at no stage did I think he was getting Delacroix. The official distance was 3/4 of a length. I thought it was far more emphatic than that. And I would say, unfortunately or fortunately, depending whether you're a bloodstock guru or a racing guru, I'd say that's the last time we will see Delacroix on the racetrack, because as Aidan said, he is just so important to their breed because of Dubawi. And it looks like his Irish Champion Stakes win was a swan song.
I mean, what a race. What a race-winning move by Christophe Soumillon on Delacroix. But is this really going to be the last we've seen of him? DJ, give us hope. Surely, surely there's not. There's one more outing at least for Delacroix.
He offered me 1-10 now about Delacroix not running again. I would take it. I think that's value. I just think he's won an Eclipse. He's won an Irish Champion Stakes. He's shown speed. And for the breed, we know that speed is so important. He's shown that burst, that acceleration. And I was there. I was face to face with Aidan when I was asking him these questions. And you can just tell from his tone, you can tell from everything about him that this is probably it for Delacroix. And, you know, what a season he's had. Like, he was one of these, at the start of the season, I don't think anybody was thinking that Delacroix could potentially be the story of the season. We were thinking the line in winter. We were thinking, you know, of the various other three-year-olds that Aidan had coming through that might be the best. And obviously, Lambourne won two derbies. But Delacroix has been the story of the season and Ballydoyle. So I would say, unfortunately, Tom, I know it's not what you want to hear, but I think that is our last time seeing Delacroix.
That's sad. A sad fact, isn't it? Incredible to think Delacroix got absolutely stuffed at Epsom. He's gone on, won the Eclipse, and now bounced back to win the Irish Champion Stakes in such striking fashion, Maddie. Just quickly on the value of the form at Leopardstown, Aidan obviously did his best to try and goad John Gosden into sending over Ombudsman. Didn't happen. John gave a slightly testy response talking about the running against multiple Ballydoyle runners. You know, has he beaten a top-class field there?
I think it's decent enough. You know, last year's Champion Stakes winner, Amma, is remarkably consistent at the very top level. And some of those in behind, I think, you know, Shin Emperor had been unlucky, arguably, not to win the race last year. There was some depth to it. I don't think there was another sort of horse on his level in the race, but that's testament to how good he is. I mean, he's going to be taking this St Mark's Basilica route now, isn't he, of Eclipse, Irish Champion, and then straight to retirement, it seems. You know, St Mark's Basilica's actually doing really well with his two-year-olds this year. Obviously, he had Aylin and Diamond Necklace over the weekend. So I guess that shows, you know, this is working in some aspects for Coolmore, shuttling their horses off to stud as soon as they possibly can, but I just find it disappointing that the bloodstock arena is wagging the tail of the dog when it comes to the racing. You know, we want champions. You know, we're so lucky to have Frankel, I thought, for more than his three-year-old season. You know, if he was in Coolmore's hands, I don't think we'd have seen him at four. See the Stars, okay, only at three, but what a three-year-old career it was. They're just so hard to come by, those excellent horses. Delacroix, very good, but for me, I just want to see more.
Yeah, that's it, isn't it, James? Not only is he not likely to race at four, but he's not even going to really see out a three-year-old season.
No, and the Champions Day, which is the point of a calendar where you look at and go, this is where we really find out the final word, you know, is it Ombudsman, is it Delacroix? We won't get that answer, as it seems.
Well, quickly, who would it be? Ombudsman, Delacroix?
I would have gone Delacroix because...
Ombudsman. Yeah, I'm with DJ.
I think Delacroix has been improving through the season, so I think he's possibly going to continue improving, but and also he's got proven form on a bit of cut in the ground.
No chance. No.
Yeah?
All in on Ombudsman.
Yeah, well, he's going to need his own pacemaker and do things his own way. But we'll never find out.
Oh, alas, alas. DJ, in 30 seconds, what else do people need to know from Irish Champions Festival?
Well, I suppose two things. First of all, Eve Johnson-Houghton, like, what a legend she is, to bring over Zavattery, to come into the Lions then, to beat Aidan O'Brien, prove it can be done, and Carol Burke, three winners over Irish champions weekend. And now British trainers might realise, do you know what? We actually can go over and win over there. I know Aidan wins almost everything, but he doesn't win absolutely everything, and we can go and win. Carol Burke, three winners. Eve Johnson-Houghton, a big winner in the national stakes. So I think it was brilliant for the future of the Irish Champions Festival that the English team did so well. And I think we're going to see more next year. And as I wrote in my piece today, we need to see more British racegoers appreciating Irish Champions Festival, because we see the Dublin Racing Festival where there's so many British come over. I think Maddie, James might have both been there. A lot of the Racing Post team go over for that weekend as their enjoyable weekend, as unassociable. Whereas I think we need to get more British racegoers to the Irish Racing Festival, because they are two really good days.
Excellent. We'll see you there next year, DJ. We're going to move on now to the St. Ledger meeting at Doncaster, and in particular, the final British Classic. It was a similar story. Aidan O'Brien once again winning Scandinavia, toughing it out quite impressively. But maybe the bigger story is Derby, dual Derby winner Lambourne, who had plenty of support, including, I'm sorry to say, my tenor, just running a nothing race again.
She's just not that good, Tom, I think. You know, it seems crazy to say about a dual Derby winner, but we know they're not a strong crop of three-year-old colts this year. He got the perfect ride at Epsom, didn't beat loads when he won at the Curragh, and again was just ridden optimally. And maybe he's soured a little bit since then. Obviously, in the Great Voltager, we thought maybe he was just a bit rusty and he would come on. And he did look to have come on for that for most of the race at Doncaster, but was just outclassed for my reckoning. I thought it was a wonderful race, wasn't it? You want truly run proper tests. And I think that's exactly what the St. Ledger was. Every horse had their fair shot at it. Thought Scandinavia was showed a real good attitude to get on top. There's been three lower RPRs this decade, so it was an outstanding performance on the clock. I don't think he's probably going to go down as a spectacular winner. He's not the sort of horse who I could see winning in King George or something like that. But who knows? Melbourne Cup could be next. But the one thing that I took out of the action at Doncaster was just the atmosphere. Even through the TV, it was palpable, and you really sensed that excitement, that sort of community spirit, and just enjoyment of everyone having a good day at the races. And that stretched to the Curragh as well. It was just great action. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, the atmosphere at Doncaster seemed to be absolutely jumping, James. Incredible fact in today's edition, which is that the St. Ledger attendance was 27,000, a bit of a growth year on year. It's now the best attended British Classic after the Derby slumped this year to just over 22,000. That's incredible. You would never anticipate that, would you?
Yeah, I think sometimes in racing, we're quite guilty of tarring things of a certain brush. And the way that the season and the way horses are trained has evolved is sort of the Ledger sort of not quite as sexy as a classic as the Guineas and the Derby, which have held up their own. And sort of the way horses are bred and the Ledger now often producing jump stallions, there's this idea in racing that, well, it's not quite what it used to be. But clearly in the local community, which is often what drives attendances, it's still got a massive place. And, you know...
And that's it, isn't it?
Because it's the key, yeah.
You know, Newmarket. Well, you know, Newmarket's in a reasonably small town and in a not particularly densely populated part of the country. Yep. Epsom famously struggled to connect with the local community. You're not a million miles away, Maddie.
No.
But Doncaster loves the St. Ledger.
I think that's exactly it. It's community engagement. It's something we see York do particularly well. Mm. They really are in touch with their roots and what the local people love. And Donny, I mean, I was walking around weirdly an antique shop yesterday, and there was like three photographs of like St. Ledger winners back in the 1800s or very early 1900s. And you just think, yeah, I think it's just managed to capture and retain that history, which some of the other classics maybe haven't. They've maybe changed too much, or, you know, they've almost tried to adapt too much. Whereas Doncaster seem to just, they're proud of what they've got, and that it works for them.
Yeah, well, great to see such positive attendances up at Doncaster. Just turn back to Scandinavia for a second, James. What's going to be next, and
well,
what do we think of the form?
Depends what the vets think, because the Melbourne Cup is a likely target. He's a winner over 2 miles. He's a top class 3-year-old. We know how much of an emergence there is on European horses going to Melbourne Cup. But last year, with the scans in the Melbourne Cup and horses not being able to run, has really put a question mark over the ambition to go to Australia. I think they'll possibly look at the Melbourne Cup. They'd like to. He's got the obvious profile. I wouldn't fancy him at all. I'd be happy to.
I don't know if Aidan's soured on.
I think, it's a really tough ask to say, you sent a horse down there, you really fancied him. You think he's fine. The vets take a look and say, no, he isn't. It's tough to then go next year, okay, we're going to have another go. But of the Aidan O'Brien crop, he's one of the ones which could do it. And we know, I think Aidan would love to win that race because his son has. But yeah, not Aidan. There's not many things Joseph has done and Aidan hasn't. And right. Joseph, of course, got the favourite in Al Riffer, who won on the Irish St. Ledger.
Of course, yeah. DJ, what do you think? Is there a chance of a trip to Melbourne?
I would love it, because there's obviously, as we know, this conflict between Aidan and Racing Victoria. And if Scandinavia were to go down there and pass the vets and win the Melbourne Cup, I think Aidan would take great satisfaction in that for numerous different reasons. And he would be, I won't say what, to Racing Victoria. Look, I was surprised. I said it to him straight after the race when Scandinavia won the Melbourne or won the Ledger. I said, "What's the plans now?" And immediately he said that the Melbourne Cup, that was part of the plan. And I was like, "Whoa, wasn't expecting that." He would have a chance because he's just so tenacious and hates losing and just keeps on grinding and grinding. And just one thing I will say, which is interesting about the attendances at Doncaster, you would think the focal point of the festival obviously is the St. Ledger, which has been completely, totally and utterly dominated by Aidan O'Brien in the last couple of years. Not only has he won it for the last 3 years, it's like Aidan A versus Aidan B versus Aidan C, as we saw with Scandinavia, Lambourne and Stay True on Saturday. So obviously the actual race itself is not really having an impact on the attendance, because you would think that when one trainer utterly dominates a race like that, that the outside public might be a little bit browned off, but obviously it doesn't. So it's just an interesting point to factor in, that maybe the actual makeup of the race doesn't actually affect attendances.
I don't think they'd even know, would they? I think the general person going to the St. Ledger for a day out doesn't know that Aidan O'Brien
trains
half the field.
Yeah, that's my point. I don't think they do realise exactly that the same trainer is training these horses. Like, a lot of them won't realise when they go there that the three of the top four in the market are trained by the same trainer, which is obviously quite interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely raises the questions about how much competitiveness is a factor and why people attend. And speaking of competitiveness, Aidan O'Brien has now picked up 18 group or grade ones this season. He is, DJ, on course, albeit with a lot still to do, to surpass his 2017 record of 28 group or grade ones for the season. That would be astonishing. It can happen, surely?
I think it will, yeah. And I think he's a little bit unlucky in ways, because Gestad has now been just beaten, and I mean just beaten, in two group ones. Like, obviously the National Stakes, it was just on the bob with Zavateri, and then in France when Venetian Sun beat him, was just on the bob. And he's actually finished really, he's had a lot of close seconds in group ones as well. And I think he's going to give it a proper lash, because I think when you look towards like the Filly's Mile and the Dewhurst and those group ones towards the latter stage of the season, I think he's got a lot to pick from. And I think he's not just going to have one or two runners in those races, he could have three or four. And I think it will team up nicely. We've seen Diamond Necklace win on Saturday at Leopardstown. You know, she looks an ideal type for the Filly's Mile. He's got a lot of favourites. He's got a lot for the Arc weekend as well. And if Whirl goes for the Prix de l'Opera rather than going for the Arc, you'd imagine she's going to be a pretty short price for that. So that's another one you'd think he might just have in the bag. So you'd expect him to get maybe two at the very least on Arc weekend. You'd imagine to pick up maybe two or three in Britain. So that's going to get him very close to that total that he needs to get to. So I think he could do it, Tom.
Oh, it's going to be a thrilling denouement to the season, and it feels like a good point to check in more broadly on where we are with the various championships as we enter the final weeks of the season. In Britain, the Trainers' Championship, which actually runs to the end of the year, but let's just pretend it doesn't, because nothing much happens after Champions Day in terms of prize money. Aidan O'Brien, about 0.8 million clear of Andrew Boulding having a great season in second, with the Gosdens narrowly behind on about 5.7 million. Is it in the bag?
I think
another championship.
I think it is. I think the two championships actually are in the bag. Aidan O'Brien, as DJ touches on, the two-year-old races in the autumn at Newmarket. He's usually very competitive. You'd expect Champions Day to have some sort of influence. And if you're looking at the early picture, you'd say, well, who's more than likely to have the best Champions Day? It's looking at the team horses, it's probably going to be Aidan O'Brien.
Just the firepower. Yeah. So much,
It's a strength and depth, which DJ says. And you look at those two-year-old races and you go, okay, well, you know, he's got three or four who could be at the top of market. So
I wouldn't be as confident. Oh, yeah. I mean, to surpass it, he's got to have 11 Group 1 winners.
Hmm. I mean, the championship rather than the record.
Yeah.
There's a lot can go wrong on that front, isn't it? You know.
I just think as well, a lot of his horses, look at Delacroix, have been on the go for quite a while. The two-year-olds, they're very good, but there's not sort of, I don't know how much depth there is to it. I mean, we saw yesterday his third string possibly won the Moigler. I mean, that just shows how strong they are, I guess, all around. But there's not a clear pecking order. I think 11 Group 1s in a couple of months would be a big ask, even for Aidan's very high standards.
But yes to the Trainer's title.
Oh, yeah. That's done and dusted, yeah.
Jockeys. Well, Ocean Murphy is going to win another championship. There's no doubt about that. But it's really interesting. First of all, Billy Loughnan having a great season. In second place, he was fourth last year, so he's not exactly a new kid on the block, despite being extremely young. But Kieran Fallon in third, he was 34th, I think, last season, which is absolutely incredible. A bit of a changing of the guard.
Yeah, I think I spoke to Kieran would have been around this time last year, I think, and he had a bit of a knock and he took some time off, got a bit stronger, got a bit fitter and sort of renewed his way of looking at it. He had a really good season. When we first saw him break into the scene, he was getting a lot of those big Group 1 rides, the sprinters at Oxted, and he was emerging. But you often see him now at other meetings and picking up good rides for good trainers. And he's a bit of a go-to man, getting quite a lot of rides. He's obviously got the links with Haggis. So, yeah, he's had a really good season. And you talk about Billy Loughnan. I mean, the biggest frustration I have is that the Jockeys Championship is Guineas weekend to Champions Day, because actually it'd be very close if it was January to December. Billy Loughnan was in superb form on the all weather, so
he could seriously win it next year though.
Yeah, seriously, yeah.
Do we think he could be future number one for Godolphin, maybe? Starting those links there, that relationship's very, very strong. They seem to grab for him whenever he's free.
Yeah.
I wonder if already he's been primed for William Buick's seat.
Well, and I know, and William Buick, late 30s, you know, could be running for a long time, but I'm sure he's casting a slightly nervous look over his shoulder now. It's you know, Billy Loughnan is the hot property in the riding ranks, certainly in Britain anyways, but there's a new hotshot in Ireland, DJ, isn't there?
Yeah, Dylan Brown McMonagall, he's 9 clear now, 77 to 68, and only 22, which is hard to believe. And I just thought the ride on Alriffa in the Irish St. Ledger was really a coming of age type of ride, because I said in my piece, it takes real guts to do what he did at Alriffa, sit him out last early in a classic on a fancied runner, and then to cut through the pack, and then, you know, a furlong and a half out still to take a pull. Like, there's very few that can do that, and he's just riding with such confidence that he's like, this is what I'm doing, this is my thing. And then Alriffa quick and clear to win by four lengths, and he just seems to have everything. Like, he looks the part, he speaks really well, he rides really well, he's only 22, he's a former pony riding sensation. he just seems to have the whole package, and you know, he's got the numbers now to back it up, and it's just very hard to see Colin Keane catching him, because Colin obviously is the number one rider for Judmont. He's going to have so many commitments on the big weekends in Ireland over in England, and I just can't see how he's going to make up that deficit. And I think Dylan, as when it comes towards the end of the season, he's going to get very close to that 100 mark, and I just can't see how Colin is going to catch him. So it looks like it's going to be a first title for Dylan.
And he has been about for donkeys, despite being 22. I mean, I was writing in the Editor's Choice email I sent to subscribers at the weekend about seeing him win on video the Dingle Derby 10 years ago when he was 12. It's just extraordinary.
It is. It just seems like, even when I asked, like, I think I asked him something about, like, you know, do you remember Mick Cannane riding or something? He was like, oh, not really. I was like, whoa, Mick Cannane was only yesterday, like.
Oh, we're getting old, DJ. What can I say?
Oh, God, yeah. Like, he's 22, going on 62, like, and even the way he talks, like, it's so funny. If you see him being interviewed, like, he just says all the right things. He's the right demeanor. It's like he's had 100 years of media training. He just is, like, if the industry wants somebody to promote the sport, he's the type of guy you want, because kids will look up to this guy and say, God, I want to be like him. Because even when I was interviewing him, I was like, I want to be like him. So yeah, he's got a huge future. My God, he's 22. What is he going to do in the next 20 years?
Well, that's number one for Aidan, I think. Not to jump back on the Billy Lucknane thing, but yeah. do we not think, DJ? I mean, he's ridden for the Coolmore outfit plenty already, only 22. Sumeon's obviously deputising for Moore at the minute. That's an uncertain picture, but he seems, again, almost like it sounds awful, but being groomed for that role eventually.
Yeah, I don't want to knock Ryan Moore when he's down. I know Ryan actually watches this show every single week. So, Ryan, if you're watching, I think you've got a good decade or so ahead of you, to be honest.
Of course.
I'd imagine Dylan is, if you were to price up who's going to be the new Ballydoyle number one in 2035, when Ryan Moore mightn't just be riding, I'd say Dylan Bremick-Monaghan would be a pretty sharp price favourite.
Well, it's exciting, though, that we've got in both sides of the IRC some really exciting, bright young talent.
And you touched on who's going to be potentially the next number one. A few of them had a good chance. I mean, with Ryan Moore out, it has just opened the door a little bit. And I thought Tom Wakanda, every time he's had the opportunity, he has stepped forward. And whether he's necessarily that, but it's interesting how those rides have come available, and these jockeys who have been on the cusp of really that top bracket of elite Group 1 riders week in, week out, how that door's opened and who's taken advantage is fascinating.
Maybe it's the swings and roundabouts of all these jockeys going elsewhere. I mean, obviously the big ones, Dottori in America, Ben Curtis, another one who's gone over there. You've had David Probert and Richard Kingsgate both go off to Hong Kong. I mean, these are going to result in more spare rides becoming available. And I wonder if that's a slightly more positive take on it. Well, give someone else a chance now that the rides are coming up.
Yeah, look, always sad when we see big talents leaving these shores, but that is the flip side. Well, look, let's move on, and let's move on to a slightly less pleasant subject, because there's been a couple of corruption cases unfolding over the last week. We'll start, James, with the Hilson case. Now, for those who understandably might have forgotten, it was 2 years ago now that Dylan Kitts was accused of deliberately stopping a horse, Hilson, at Worcester. The case has finally come before the BHA's disciplinary panel, and some pretty sensational details have emerged. What have we heard?
Well, we have heard in the last few days more from Dylan Kitts' side of the story. This is filming on Monday. We're at essentially almost a bit of a midway point.
The case resumes today. The case resumes. It's ongoing, so we can only say so much as well for legal reasons.
Dylan Kitts has admitted that he had stopped the horse. He's given a few explanations as to why, some of which involving John Higgins, who is on behalf of the ownership group,
an associate of
Alan Clegg, who is not involved in the hearing at all. John Higgins denies all involvement, as does trainer Chris Honour. But as we say, we're going to hear more from different parties with the week to come. And Dylan talks about potential threats that he's had from Higgins and the associates. And it's a bit of a murky tale, in truth. We're still going to find out the full story, and it's too early to sort of make huge summarizations. But this is an example of how racing can be at times. You know, there is threats. Jockeys are on not too much money at times in their careers, and they can be prone and suspect.
There's certainly the perception that this happens in racing, and some of the details, you know, Kitts has, who's left the sport and says he has no reason to tell anything other than the truth, talked about expletive-laden phone calls, yep. And you know, if you have to break your neck to make sure you don't win, then so be it. And some bizarre details as well. Dylan Kitts, after he left the sport, got a tattoo of Hilson on his backside.
Yeah. So we should say now that Dylan has since not ridden since. He's also decided not to continue his career. It's a way to look at the sport differently, because we all feel there's this idea that these things happen in racing. It's rare that the details are really laid bare as they have been in this investigation. This case, when it happened 2 years ago, was so obvious. It was, you didn't need to be an expert in horse racing or judge racing or watch it to see what had happened. And it was uncomfortable to see. And the fact that has been such a big investigation and the details are going to be fully revealed is great. I have to say, though, this is 2 years ago.
Yeah.
This is a long time. And I know a lot of work's gone into this investigation, but these people's careers have been on hold, essentially, because of this investigation, which has been a cloud over them. And regardless of what happens, I do half feel in the back of my mind that great that this is going to be given so much detail, but my word, we need to get resolutions a bit quicker.
And it's also the perception of racing to fans as well. And that's a good point to bring in the other case that emerged last week. And we can say very little about this because it's a joint investigation by Greater Manchester Police and the Gambling Commission. And a 42-year-old man was arrested in connection with allegations of race fixing. The investigation was launched following reports of a suspicious betting activity. Needless to say, any ongoing legal matter, there's very little that journalists can say legally. So while we cannot say a lot today, we will be covering these stories in full across the Racing Post platforms. And indeed, the Hilson case, worth emphasising, resumes today, Monday, and we will have detailed coverage later in the day. Let's move on to the aftermath of the racing strike and the associated debate within the sport about exactly what position racing should be taking. So, of course, racing went dark last week, and so did the front cover of the Racing Post. This was in protest at government plans to harmonise betting taxes. I was at the event in Westminster.
What did you think?
As strikes go, it was less visual than some of them. It probably was the first strike, I think, that there was a free bar beforehand.
That's racing for
you. Yeah, and The Guardian described it as a strike day with a dress code, which I loved. Yeah. There was literally a dress code. But, you know, that's racing. That's how racing does events, and it was never going to be getting the braziers out and, you know, engaging in sort of running battles with the police. So it was a slightly oddly polite protest. But I guess it achieved its goal, which was to get the story in front of a wider audience, and particularly to highlight to the government that, you know, strength of feeling within the sport about what this would mean for racing.
Yeah, I mean, interesting you say about it being a polite protest. I mean, it's a tricky one because racing, we're not often known for the actions that we take. We're known for sort of being paralysed. And good that any action was taken at the end of the day. It's better than nothing. And I do sympathise because I think, you know, it probably wouldn't be the wisest move to go in there all guns blazing and alienate the government at such a crucial time. And I think visibility probably counts for a lot. You know, I know you said it wasn't massively visible, but just showing face, being there, so many of racing's leading figures coming out and contributing to the efforts, I think probably counts for a lot. Whether they could have been more aggressive in their campaigning and their stance, maybe, but I mean, I'm not a politician. I could see why that wouldn't be an attractive option when it comes to the positioning of racing. Seemed okay.
Yeah, what do you think, James? Should racing have got some racehorses? You know, the farmers, of course, who have been protesting so vigorously about the inheritance tax changes. You know, they've filled Whitehall with tractors. They've been very sort of animated, very vocal. You know, much more militant than racing has been.
Yeah,
racing obviously chose not to go down that route. Didn't want to antagonise the government more than the strike action was doing. But is that right?
I think we've seen that strike and indeed the tube strike. They're very emotive, aren't they? Sort of pedestrians trying to get through on the trains, and it's been a nightmare at getting around London last week. And the farmers, all of the imagery of that. I think it was big and it was broad, and there was a lot of anger and frustration, which was in part of it. This strike, you say, it was done in a different way, and I don't know what the right way to strike is. It's not something I would ever know. This one was slightly disappointing for me on the front. I mean, you talk about racing doing racing things, being critical is the number one above being polite. And there were only a handful of MPs there. Perhaps the turnout was a little bit disappointing. You'd have liked to have seen a few more there. But, you know, just because they're not there doesn't mean they're not listening. And the coverage has been good. And I think that's the most important element. It's how the lesson comes.
I think the fact the Treasury released a statement beforehand, kind of chastising racing for going ahead with this, saying there's no plans to raise taxes.
Yeah, don't worry about it, guys.
I think the fact that they felt the need to say something at all is probably indicative that this has got under the skin of government a little bit, but also that they are fully aware now of the strength of feeling within racing and also the arguments that racing is making.
And I think the important thing is that it's raising a bit more awareness of the aspects of why racing should be treated differently. Mm. Because I think there'll be a lot of people who don't quite understand the sport, who are looking at the way the country is and looking at the way finances, the economics are of the country are, and looking at racing and going, well, why should racing? What does racing feel that it needs to be treated differently? Mm. And actually spelling it out and going, okay, well, there's a difference in running an online casino and training a racehorse and all the different aspects that racing has. And I think really explaining that and making that clear, I think, is a really good, important thing, not just for MPs, but also the wider public. And the second thing, which I think is hugely important, and I think that there's been a bit of awareness driven from it, I hope there's a bit more, is that racing has so many knock-on effects to the economy. I mean, I live in Cheltenham. Mm. I mean, the impact that Cheltenham has, I mean, let's not get into hotels and pints of Guinness, but from
plenty of time for that over the coming
months. Almost there. We're not far away. But the impact it has across a huge range of businesses. It's not just the pubs and the restaurants. Yeah. I mean, I remember a few months ago, someone was telling me, oh, we love having the races here because we get more people having their haircut. You know, you don't think, oh, wow, there's races on. But there are so many different industries which are hit, which will be hurt. And so anything that impacts racing has a massive effect to communities, both big towns where racecourses are and indeed rural.
And I think that's one thing I want to touch on, and I'm sort of piggybacking off a point you made a minute ago, James, is that racing employs so many people. And probably the general public, I mean, Chris wrote a piece about how he walked past a woman with a pushchair and she sort of said, oh, what's all this about? And he explained and she went, oh, that seems like nonsense. And I think getting that core idea out to a wider group of people is what's needed. What maybe racing could have done more was just appeal to the general public a bit more with the strike. You know, when you're talking about, you said stable staff and their jobs are going to be on the line, could we have seen some more of them contributing and really speaking up? And I think that's the risk that we have when racing does a racing approach, is that it doesn't necessarily find ways to connect with the general public.
Yeah, there was a lot of chat at the event on Wednesday about things like the fall crop, which is undoubtedly a very significant issue, but definitely leaves the general public a little bit confused, I think.
Yeah.
Whereas, I agree with you, if you start talking about the very real and tangible impact that racing has on local communities, providing livelihoods in such a diverse range of businesses and occupations, then that's when you start to understand that this is not just a sport, or still less a gambling product. It is a industry that has a enormous impact across the
an industry and a community. You know, this is key to a lot of people's enjoyment and happiness, as well as how they make their money.
Completely.
I think if there's one key message to take away from anything I would have said, is that there's still a bit of time to go. And I think it's important that momentum, maybe not to the same level as last week, but it's important that message continues to come out, because look, there's a lot going to go into the budget. There is a lot of talking points, and this is going to fall down the agenda. So it's important that racing continues to press and not just go, okay, we've done our strike, job done. Keep up. So people out there, keep writing to MPs or doing whatever you want.
Completely, yeah. November 26th, the budget Rachel Rees will deliver. Just finally, before we close on this subject and the show, DJ, I'd love to get your impression from watching from relatively afar. What did you think of the racing strike in Britain, British Racing's attempts to get its voice heard?
I ask a stupid question, and I know I've spent a career asking stupid questions, but was there potential, just say, to have the strike on a Saturday when the St. Ledger was on? Because I just think, if you want to actually make a statement, and the more I think about it, the more I wonder, if you want to make a statement, when you talk to anybody that's kind of has a passing interest in racing, they automatically think Saturday. Saturday is the racing day. It's when they don't care about it during the week, but it's on ITV on a Saturday. And if you actually didn't have racing on Saturday when the St. Ledger was on, when it was this huge Saturday, and I know it's worth so much money to the industry, but if you are talking about a decision here that could impact the whole future of the sport forevermore, was Saturday the day to actually have the strike? I'm not saying I'm not intelligent enough to know whether that is just a ridiculous statement that makes no sense whatsoever. How could you be so stupid to suggest that? But I'm just thinking of the wider public. If there was no racing on Saturday when the St. Ledger was supposed to be on, is that not the moment that everybody would have went, whoa, what the hell is going on here? Why is there no racing? I went into the bookies and there's no racing on. I switched on ITV, there's no racing on. What's going on here? Was there the potential to have the strike on the Saturday, Tom?
The potential to have it in any day, DJ. But the decision was made, I suspect, very much with one eye on what an acceptable level of cost to the industry would be. I think doing it on a Wednesday cost racing £200,000 once the net position is considered, because the meetings were rearranged. Doing it on a Saturday would probably cost millions. But would that have been a price worth paying for that?
Well, that's my point. I'm just thinking, if you're talking about the future of the sport forevermore in Britain, was it a price worth paying? I don't know the answer. And maybe there'll be people watching this and going, look, he's an even bigger egot than I thought he was by suggesting that. But it's just something that has crossed my mind in the last week or so.
Well, I think it's a good question. And we will only find out on November 26th whether racing's efforts have been enough to persuade the government and Chancellor Rachel Reeves not to raise taxes on horse racing betting. We'll obviously be following that story over the coming months as racing continues to try and get its message heard. And of course, we'll be continuing our extensive coverage of all things racing on the Racing Post digital channels, in the newspaper, and on this show. We'll be back next week for more racing discussion. Thank you very much for joining us. Thank you to my panelists, and we will see you next week.